Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is John Paul.
And this is your second bonus X Tuesday episode for March 9th, 2021. And today, John Paul and I are going to be talking about Powers of 10, number 5. And this was an interesting issue. It doesn't quite live up to the sort of groundbreaking, earth-shattering revelations that we got in House of X, number 5. With learning how the mutants are basically immortal, but there's a lot of important things here. It's basically like House of X number 5 sort of told us, okay, here's how it's going to work, or here's how it does work with the mutants being able to resurrect themselves. And now we're flashing back and seeing how the groundwork was laid for that, as well as some other things that allowed the mutant nation to come into existence. So it makes for a good read, an interesting read. I'm not sure why Mr. Sinister is on the main cover, but it is Mr. Sinister, the version of Mr. Sinister that has the X gene. And it's an interesting enough picture. You know, he's kind of standing there in front of the golden balls, the eggs, as some mutants are hatching. So maybe it's just to remind us, hey, the mutants are immortal now. You know, why don't you dive into the issue and we'll kind of explain how it happens. So inside the front cover, the quote is from Professor X, and he says, "They will think we are doing one thing, but the truth is we are doing something altogether different." And I think that's in relation to, as they start to set this up, you know, in terms of, hey, why are we building a database of DNA for all the mutants? Why are we storing all the minds back, these backups of who a mutant is and his personality and his mind and his memories? Why are we agreeing to supply this miraculous mutant drug that can heal all sorts of various ailments? You know, they think that we're doing it for one reason when really we have ulterior motives. I think that's what Professor X is getting at there. So as we turn the page, we get the credits, written by Jonathan Hickman, R.B. Silva as artist, Marte Garcia handling the colors, and Clayton Cowell on the letters. And then we dive into the issue itself. But before I do that, I did want to ask you, John Paul, what do you think that quote means from Professor X inside that front cover?
What was the quote again?
They will think we are doing one thing, but the truth is we're doing something altogether different.
I think it'll be clear once you read House of X 6, because I started reading that just a moment ago, and I don't know why that quote is placed here. It should really be in that issue.
Okay, fair enough. Well, this one starts off, we're actually flashing back to X to the Zero, the X-Men Year One, Dallas, Texas. And we see Cerebro is there on a table. Professor X is saying, "My question is, can it be done?" And we see a response from off panel saying, "You know what they say, Professor, there's nothing that can't be done. The real question is one of feasibility. For example, what are the energy costs of these improvements? What you want means we need access to a fusion reactor. That's something that doesn't exist on Earth. You know, is that really a workable solution?" And Professor X is like, "Well, let's just say this is hypothetical. Like, can you do it, hypothetically speaking? You know, forget about the power requirements." And as we pan back, we see it's Forge and Professor X, and they're talking about making some changes to Cerebro. And these are exactly the kind of problems that, you know, hypothetical problems that Forge loves to theorize about, right? So he says, "Okay, you're on what, your third generation of Cerebro?" And Professor X says, "Oh, we're on our fourth. First one was basically my design. Most of the improvements since then have been regarding range and sensitivity, and that's all been Henry McCoy's doing." And Ford says, "And now you want to go completely beyond that functionality, right? You want the ability to not only locate a mutant on the planet, but also copy the mutant's mind. You want to make a backup of a sentient being." So again, this is completely a retcon, something Professor X supposedly did way back when in the latest of Moira's life. And Professor X says, "Yeah, basically, I tried to bring it up to McCoy, but he was pretty positive that it couldn't be done." And Forge is like, "Well, Beast is smart, but you know, this kind of machine building is probably outside his expertise. And as I see, you have two problems. first of all, volume, right? There are a lot of mutant minds out there and the numbers growing every year. And then the idea of redundancy. So on the small scale, you're talking about a database of all mutant minds, and you're going to have to constantly update them to new versions, right? Because who you were last year isn't the same as who you are this year. So you've got to think about being able to update them. And in the big picture, you're going to want a duplicate version of this database in case one of the databases is corrupted or destroyed or whatever, right? You can't ever afford to lose the data, so you need a backup. Professor X is like, actually, I would prefer five. The main unit, three backups, and an additional one for unforeseen complications, he calls it. And Forge is like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, if you're going to build one backup, why not build, you know, four? He says, okay, so all that's stopping you is access to an unlimited power source, and you need unlimited storage. And since nothing like that exists on Earth, then you're going to have a problem. And Professor X says, well, no, it doesn't. Not on this planet. And Forge says, oh, right. I should have seen that coming. You might be Earthbound yourself, but you of course, have access to higher powers. And we know Charles Xavier has, you know, ties to the Shi'ar. And he says, yeah, there's a cloaked antimatter engine of Imperial design currently in Earth's orbit. And I believe Shi'ar logic diamonds might be suitable for data storage. I'm not sure, you'd have to tell me. And Forge, you know, he loves building stuff. That's what he does. That's his mutant power. So the fact that he's going to get to work with this advanced Shi'ar tech must be, you know, just brings a smile to his face. He loves it. He's like, okay, well, let's take it a step further. You want me to create an entirely new system, or you want me to integrate it into one that already exists? And Professor X is like, you're the only one qualified to make that call. The only question I have is, are you or are you not going to build it for me? And, you know, the smile on Forge's face is pretty much, you know, the answer that we need. So there's the answer to the question, how did Cerebro get this ability? It wasn't that it always existed, as Charles or Magneto actually, hinted at to Polaris last issue or in House of X5, where he said, yeah, Cerebro was always able to do this. Well, no, not really. Early on, yes, you know, certainly early on, very early, it was able to do this, but it was because Charles wanted it to. So I've always loved Forge. I think he's a really underrated mutant. I kind of liked when he was more of an active member of the X-Men, although I understand why he's not, because he's not really suited for that. But man, the guy's a great mechanic, no doubt. On the next page, it's a text page, and we're told about Cerebro version 7.0, build C_2. And it says it was originally powered by a Shi'ar antimatter engine. The current build is now powered by a Krakoan no place vent, which we don't exactly know what that is at this point. But this no place vent has been converted by Forge to act as an unlimited power source for mutants living on the island. Shi'ar logic diamonds do remain the primary source for data storage, and they're also how Sinister's DNA sequencing is cached. And then there's a note, Forge's increasing master of Krakoan tech, which is actually biological in nature, continues unabated. I mean, he's the best one to figure out how to integrate technology with biological makings and biological tech of Krakoa. The transition of his prowess with traditional machine building to biological machine building remains impressive. A revolution in Krakoan technology seems imminent. So again, love that idea. Doesn't matter what kind of tech it is, what kind of machinery it is, whether it's technological or biological, Forge is going to be able to figure it out. As far as the functionality of Cerebro, in terms of backup, once a week, Charles copies the latest versions of every mutant mind and multiple redundant cradles all around the world. And these backups are basically the essence of each mutant, like we talked about, their mind, their memories, their feelings, who they are, how they think, how they feel, all that stuff. The partial process takes approximately 3 hours. And it is a partial process because you're basically just sort of, to put it in computer terms, you're only copying the changes, right? Only it's like doing a backup of your computer, where your current backup is compared to what your computer looks like now, and the only thing that's copied over is what has changed. Everything else stays the same. But once a year, Xavier does a hard backup of each mutant. And unlike the weekly backups, the process is not partial. It's basically taking a fresh copy of the whole mind. And this process takes 3 days, during which the process cannot be interrupted and Xavier cannot be disturbed. It's a pretty big time commitment for Xavier. And I'm assuming when he says process takes 3 days, 3 days to do everybody. And that must increase over time as more mutants are awakened, because 3 days per mutant wouldn't work. He would be doing nothing but copying people all year long. And there also is a note, as previously stated, while there's been no experimentation regarding what happens when you combine a mutant mind with a husk that's not their own, it's believed that unless the mutant mind has some primary or secondary ability to overcome damage, to the brain that mismatch would cause, it's likely to be harmful and maybe even fatal. It is possible for a telepathic operator to replace their own mind with a previous version that's been saved, a legacy version they call it, but doing so is incredibly difficult and would likely require a skilled and experienced operator. Note, Charles Xavier has done this twice. Now, has he done that to his own mind, somebody else's mind? Not exactly clear. But it is all this stuff is interesting. And I'm sure that anybody who skipped this, they're not really losing out on much information. It's, kind of technical, but I do find it interesting. We also get the locations of the cradles. There's one at the House of X, one at Island M, one at Summer House, one at the Point, and one in Moira's No Place, whatever that is. So pretty cool the way Cerebro works now, but there's still that underlying flaw that we had pointed out last time, John Paul, of consent and lack of privacy. Although I would probably agree to have my mind read and all my secrets laid bare if it meant I could be immortal. How about you?
I'd give it some second thought, but perhaps I'd have to really think about it.
Fair enough. We jump forward now. We're at X to the One, the year X-Men Year One. We're at the Louvre. And this is where Xavier and Magneto first encounter the White Queen and bring her on board. So Xavier sends everybody to command everyone out, and everybody kind of, these are not the droids you're looking for, and they all leave, and White Queen is the only one left there. And so Xavier approaches her. She's not necessarily surprised to see him, and in fact, she says, you can stop skulking around. You haven't been subtle enough for that to work for a long time. And, I felt you looking for me at the Canova, and this seemed like a more appropriate place to meet. And she wants to know why he's there. And then Magneto makes himself known and says, same reason I am. Good to see you. And she's like, oh, great. The two of you together, this is going to be either really heroic or terrifyingly reckless. Dare I ask which? And they basically say, could it be both? And Emma's like, you know what? I'm running late. I'm busy. What do you want? And Xavier says, well, I noticed because the Hellfire Corporation is a international prime mover. And I was wondering if you heard rumblings about this new drug coming out, this miracle drug. And she says, yeah, I'm aware of certain rumors. He said, okay, are you also aware that through a series of shell corporations and whatnot, I'm the one behind this company? And I love her response. Emma says, you were listening earlier when I talked about your lack of subtlety, right? Like, of course she knew. And Xavier says, okay, fair enough. But what about the motive behind it? Are you aware of that? These drugs are leveraged to establish a mutant nation, Krakoa. And the shock on Emma's face, she's like, okay. So not heroic at all, just really, really reckless. Let's put all the mutants on an island again, right? Just one big target. You should know better. And she's pointing to Magneto. And she turns to Xavier and says, and you think I'd want to help with this to gather all the mutants together in one place so they can be attacked and killed again? And Xavier says, well, not so much us helping us gather the mutants together as much as forming the mutant government. And Emma's like, government for a nation that doesn't exist, based on the leverage you're going to create with some imaginary drug to get the trust of people that would rather kill us than trust us? Like, you guys are out of your minds. Aren't you getting a little ahead of yourselves? And Magneto says, look, in a month, the population of Krakoa will seemingly overnight expand from several mutants to over 100,000. 3 months later, it'll be five times that. And by this time next year, it could be as high as 2 million. We are not ahead of ourselves. In fact, we're already woefully behind. And we know what Emma doesn't know at this point is the way they're going to increase that population is by resurrecting dead mutants. So, you know, they don't have to worry about mutants hooking up and waiting for babies to be born and all that and grow up and you know, become productive parts of this Krakoan nation. You know, they're going to be popping them out at a rate of 1,000 a day. And so that's at that point, that's when Emma realizes they're serious. And Xavier says, yeah, this is the day that you've been waiting for. And Magneto says, look, we have a chance to make everything right, all the things that went wrong. And I know time travel is not a big part of this story, other than the fact that in a way, Moira is sort of traveling through time because she lives a life and then dies and she's reborn back in the past. But that line by Magneto, to make right all the things that went wrong, I immediately thought of Quantum Leap, you know, the Scott Bakula show, to put right what once went wrong. And that's really what they're trying to do with this nation here. So Emma wants to know, well, what's going to make it different this time? And Magneto shows her some technology from Krakoa and what their plans are. So then we jump up to later. We're on Krakoa. And now that she's sort of seen it with her own eyes, she agrees with Xavier and Magneto and says, okay, I'm in. Tell me what you need. And so what Xavier wants us to do is, okay, so the companies I've created, they're manufacturing the drugs at scale, and the raw materials are the flowers of Krakoa itself, so they can't, you know, they only grow here. Any argument against us having a monopoly or controlling things, you know, disintegrates because this is our sovereign nation and our land, and we're the only ones that have access. But that's where Emma comes in, right? Because they can't trust any human distribution to not screw things up or hoard a bunch of the pills so they can tell the mutants, we don't need you anymore, and attack and try to take over the island. So they're coming to Emma as the head of the Hellfire Corporation because the Hellfire Corporation already has the international distribution to be able to send the drugs out everywhere. And so she basically says, okay, so you guys want me to become the East India Trading Company of Mutantdom? And Xavier's like, yeah, basically. And Emma's like, okay, you know, I kind of like the taste of that. I mean, she's certainly going to make a lot of money doing it. And I love it. Magneto says, yeah, we'd be willing to formalize the arrangement. And we were thinking of a 20-year. And she just looks at him. He says, yeah, like I was saying, we were thinking of a 50-year exclusive contract. She's like, better, you know, that'll work. And Xavier's like, okay, forget about the money talk. What's really important is we're offering you two seats on the 12-person council that's going to act as the first government of Krakoa. And Emma's like, wait a second, this council's temporary, right? Like, you're going to agree on a more formal structure at some point. Everybody's going to get a vote kind of thing. And Xavier says, maybe. We'll find our way as we grow, but this is going to be the start, right? The spark that sets things in motion. And she says, okay, but why two seats? And Magneto and Xavier look at each other and they said, well, because we need you to bring Sebastian Shaw into the Hellfire. And the look on Emma's face, she raises his eyebrows like, man, I just kicked him out of the Hellfire Club. And Xavier says, look, be reasonable, right? Like, you're going to be the face of the legitimate trade. Like, all the nations of the world that we negotiated with and made agreements, right? The consummate politician who works with all the countries we have official relationships with. But for the countries that we don't have official relationships with, and then Emma realized, oh, so you want the Black King to run the black market operations and to make sure the drug goes out to countries who didn't agree. And they said, yeah, basically get the drugs in, get the mutants out. Can we count on you? Will you do it? And Emma says, yeah, I'll do it, but not for two seats on the council. She says she'll be needing three of the 12. So who she has in mind for the third, we don't know at this point. On the next page, it's another text page, and we learn about the Quiet Council, as they're called, of Krakoa. It's the 12-person ruling council that decides how the mutant nation handles external conflicts and what the internal laws of the island itself are. And there's some debate as to whether the council is going to continue to rule the island as a system of government forever or if something's going to replace it at some point. So they're divided into four seasons, and then Krakoa itself has a voice. So the autumn season, there's three seats in each of the seasons, except for Krakoa has two. And that makes up the 14 seats, with the 12 being, you know, mutants that are actually chosen, if you will. And then, as I said, Krakoa has a voice. So each of the seasons has three. We know Autumn is Professor X and Magneto. We don't know who the third one is. It's blacked out. Winter's all three are blacked out. We don't know who. Spring is the Black King, Sebastian Shaw. White Queen, Emma Frost, and someone else who's blacked out, who Emma must want on there. And then Summer's all blacked out as well, so we don't know who that is. The Krakoan representatives are Krakoa itself, and then Cypher, who probably helps to sort of translate and understands Krakoa and can, you know, lives in both worlds, understands Krakoa and the needs and the kind of the biological nature of Krakoa, as well as understands what it is to be human. So that's why he's on the council. And then we get a diagram of the chamber, I guess, of the council. And then we see Xavier out on the island itself. It's still X to the one. We're still year 10, and it's the summoning. And we see that Xavier is sending out all across the world to all mutants, saying, "Mutants of Earth, we're building something special. We're all your brothers. We're all your sisters. And now's the time to set aside all differences and realize we're one people. And I'm extending you an invitation. Join us. You have a place here. It's a place of refuge, a place of sanctuary. It's your home. And we'll be waiting for you on Krakoa." So he goes to see everybody, both villain and hero. And in fact, he goes to see Namor, who a lot of people forget is a mutant, one of the first. And when he's standing there before Namor, Namor says, "Let me see if I understand you. You're inviting all the mutants on this planet to live together on your perfect little island. The mutants that are good, the mutants that are evil, and the ones that are beyond any sort of description." And Xavier says, "Yeah, that's right. We want you to join us." And he says, "Well, it's kind of you to ask, but if I'm understanding, the real reason you're doing this is because you finally realized you're not human, right? You're not them. And they'll never accept you or love you because, not because you don't deserve to be accepted or loved, but because they envy the power that you have. They hate your superiority and they always will. And, you know, I'm glad you finally figured this out, right? But let me ask you, do I strike you as somebody who just figured this out? Do I strike you as somebody who just now realized I'm better than everybody else? And do you think that I actually think that you believe it? Xavier, who in all these lifetimes and all this time has only ever wanted to live in peaceful coexistence, you're telling me that you now feel that you're superior?" He says, "Go away, little man, and don't come back until you really mean it, until you buy into what you're selling." So that's an interesting point, interesting insight to Namor. He's saying that what Xavier is telling everybody, that Xavier doesn't actually believe it. He's just doing it because he's seen the possible future. He's seen what happens if they don't all decide to work together and form a mutant nation. Then we jump to X to the third. This is the future storyline, 1,000 years in the future. We see the Phalanx, and it's still in that shape of the construct that we had. And the humans that are left, they get the answer from the Phalanx. And the answer is that they agree. They agree to the terms. They're going to basically absorb the knowledge of Earth. They're going to become part of it. And to kind of seal the deal, we see the Phalanx sort of absorb the librarian. And later, the blue skin that's left, the librarian, is asking Nimrod, like, "Why do you think that the Phalanx destroyed the Elder?" And the Phalanx is like, "Well, there's not really enough data to make a projection, so we'll best guess then." And Nimrod says, "Okay, well, think of it this way. Humanity evolved, and so do machines. That's why you modeled us the way you did after yourself, so we could improve and we could grow. And together, this man-machine alliance that we've created here on this planet has harnessed the power of this planet, and we're approaching the ability to harness the whole solar system, which is a pretty big feat, but it's not on a universal scale. It's not mighty. And I, along with the thinking machines on this planet, were composed of smaller pieces, right? Self-replicating machines. And the Phalanx, although much bigger, it works the same way. It's obviously more sophisticated, but it's very similar. And that's not true for the Masters of the Phalanx. Those machines are made of machines, but they're not technological. They're basically created from the very fundamental components of matter, right? We're talking about universal particles, electrons, protons, leptons, possibly even primordial kirbons, and they're theoretical constructs, and they would be so massively dense because the brain, these machine brains are so big, they would dwarf any machine you could imagine. And so the question becomes, how dense are they really? Because when something gets dense enough, it collapses in upon itself, right? On space and time, and it becomes a singularity, a black hole. And the librarian says, yeah, I know this part. It's Titan theory. It states at the heart of every black hole in the universe, there's actually a supermassive machine brain, and it contains the collective intelligence of a society so that got so advanced and so dense with knowledge that it collapsed upon itself. And Nimrod says, yeah, that's right. So this argument talks about independent Titan societies, and we're sure that those exist, but ask yourself even beyond that. What is a black hole, right? It's a wormhole. It's a bridge from one singularity to the next, you know, a kind of a hole in space, if you will, like a straw, you know, one black hole on one end, one black hole on the other, and they're connected. And you have to consider that each of these black holes isn't just connected to one other black hole. They're not separate machines, but they're all part of one machine, and they're all connected, and it stretches those tendrils across the known universe. And it's one giant societal intelligence that's so far beyond anything we can imagine that you might as well think of it as God, right? The God that mankind spent so much time looking for. And the librarian says, okay, well, that's fascinating and that's terrifying, but you still haven't answered the question. Why did the Phalanx eat the elder? And the Nimrod says, well, look, we reached beyond ourselves to build a world mine and we attracted this galactic suitor. We wanted a protector. But instead of a protector, what we found was a predator and one that's hungry. The Phalanx, they're built to consume worthy cultures and incorporate its intelligence into theirs. And by extension, it incorporates the intelligence into whoever the Phalanx are working for. But that requires energy, right? It's taxing work. They got to eat to survive. And the librarian's like, okay, but I still don't – look, man, it's not an incremental deal. They've accepted – what we offered them, and now they've got to convert matter into energy. That's how this works, right? It's how they continue to exist and serve their masters. We asked for sovereignty. We asked to be independent and to be, you know, absorbed into them, but that came with a price. And the price is tomorrow, they're just going to absorb all our intelligence into theirs. All the history and the consciousness of this planet are going to live forever. But in order for that to happen, it's going to consume this entire planet and leave nothing living behind. It's nothing is free, right? You want to be part of it. You want to be absorbed. Well, we need the energy to do that. And we need the energy in order to pass this information, our history and our knowledge and our consciousness on to the larger machines. So then we get another text piece, and it's sort of a continuation of one we had before, talking about the levels of society, and it's super complex, crazy ideas from Hickman. We're talking about a societal intelligence of 10 million now, which is a Titan, and we're going to talk about how a Titan's an interstellar society with all these singularities that are linked together. And then when you go up to the next level, 100 million is a stronghold. That's a network of connected Titans. So, you know, Titans may be a singular or a few black holes linked together, a few singularities. When you talk about a stronghold, now you're talking about a group of Titans, normally five. So you're talking about 25 singularities, and it's usually in a galactic cluster or dense collection of stacked galaxies. And then when you go above that, you're talking about dominion. And that's undefined as a level of societal intelligence. But we're told that a dominion is a collective of 10 or more Titans that are acting together in unison to control a particular sector or sectors of space, both in area and epochs of time. And while the minimum number of Titans needed to compose a dominion is 10, the average number of Titans in a dominion is much, much higher than that. For example, the local dominion controlling the sector, including Earth, is collecting is a collective numbering 112 Titans. And when you think of each of those Titans has to have at least five singularities, you're talking about an awful lot of information. It does also say it's worth noting in terms of intellect and power, a Dominion is not really godlike, but categorically godlike and indistinguishable from any sort of mythic or religious comparison. So it's not really to be worshipped, but the power level of it is, it can do a lot. You know, it's very powerful. It's godlike in its abilities. And then there's also a note here, beyond universal abstracts under which dominions are seen as naturally occurring, the only primal threats that a dominion fears are the World Eater Galactus and the singular universal manifestation of life, the Phoenix, or the Phoenix Force. So dominions are extremely, extremely powerful. That's what it all comes down to. On the next page, we get an illustration of how all these societal intellects sort of play out. We got the Technarch, we got the World Mind, we got the Phalanx, and then we have the new ones that we just learned about, the Titan, the Stronghold, and the Dominion. And then on the last page, there's a quote from Namor saying, "When you see me again, understand what that means." And I'm sure that has to do with Namor's belief that Professor Xavier doesn't actually believe that mutants are superior to humans. He's just doing it out of necessity, but does know, hey, when you see me, by the time I see you again, Professor X, you're going to understand what it means, what I'm saying about mutants being superior. So that's how the issue ends. Again, it's a relatively quick read, especially if you skip the text pages in this one. The big takeaways are three things, really. How Cerebro got changed to copy the minds, bringing White Queen on board and the political ramifications of that. Plus, we learn about the ruling council. And then we flash forward and we get the stuff about the societal intelligences, which, correct me if I'm wrong, John Paul, but Hickman hasn't even explored any of that stuff yet.
No, he hasn't.
All right. Well, what did you think of this this issue overall?
The X to the 100th power?
Yeah,
the year 1000.
Yeah.
That stuff is like, I don't even know how that's X-Men connected, to be quite honest.
Because right?
We're not even talking about mutants anymore. That's some like some Stanley Kubrick, Ridley Scott, hard sci-fi type stuff, you know?
Yeah, except for Nimrod. That's the only connection. But yeah, the connection to mutants itself, don't know.
Right. So, I mean, it's fascinating, albeit very complex, but what does that have to do with X-Men? Maybe he'll connect it later on.
Well, the only thing I can think is that based on what we learn in this issue about the redundancies for the databases for X-Men DNA and X-Men personalities and memories and brain waves and all that stuff, if these the societal intelligence, if the Phalanx is absorbing all this and sending it up, passing it on up to the Titans, which then pass it to the Dominions and what have you, then aren't we talking about, again, immortality for mutants, at least in terms of their personalities and their minds living on forever as a part of the societal intelligence? And could Professor X somehow, form sort of a hive mind or a gestalt if he can become aware enough as they're absorbed into the, from the Titan to the Stronghold to the Dominion or something like that, to where they could live again as cosmic beings or something? Like, I know I'm grasping at straws, but I'm like you, I don't know what the heck Hickman is getting at here. It's out there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I'm stretching, but that's the only thing I can think of.
I mean, that's a good stretch, but I kind of disassociated mutants because the humans are looking for ascendancy, and I don't think they even considered mutants within that that same sphere. Like when they built the construct, how much of mutantdom was omitted from that? You know what I mean? Because from the get-go, they wanted to exterminate the mutants.
Right, but if the Phalanx is going to consume the entire planet for energy purposes, will they somehow, you know, I don't know, stumble across one of these cradles that held all the information and go, oh, look, here's more information. We're not going to consume that for energy. We're going to absorb that information because we agreed to save all the, you know, cultural and intelligence and whatnot of this planet. So,
well, I mean, but most of the cradles were on Krakoa, and now going back to, I think it was issue 3 of Powers of 10. Now Krakoa is not even on Earth anymore. It's like,
yeah, that's true.
An asteroid.
That's true. Right? But we don't know what changes that they made when, you know, he did say that he wanted one. What did he say? For unforeseen complications. Mm-hmm. He could have moved one. He could have hid one under the ocean. He could. Who knows? I mean, it's 1,000 years in the future, so who knows?
Right.
When the man-machine coalition started and the war against mutants started, they could have hid one, you know, somewhere under. Well, I guess I was going to say under a polar ice cap, but we don't have those anymore because all the polar ice caps have melted. But they could have put it, you know, somewhere safe, basically. So, who knows?
Maybe in Atlantis.
Yeah. Exactly. Maybe in Atlantis. It will be interesting to see if Hickman ever gets to this part of the story, if he ever fleshes it out. Or at least if he doesn't get the time to do it, at least like put it out in as like a text piece or go on a show, go on a podcast or something and tell us about it. Don't just leave us hanging.
Right.
Give us,
'cause this is fascinating stuff, but it's just,
but it's,
I'm trying to draw the connections and I'm not seeing them as clearly as all the other stuff.
Yeah. But again, you're right though. It's super dense and these concepts are, I mean, I've considered myself a pretty smart guy, and this, even for me, it's like, I got to sit here and think about it. You know, I got to read, I usually have to read this portion of the book like 2 or 3 times to make sure I'm understanding like what exactly is going on. And I'm still not sure that I'm right. I'm still doing a lot of guessing.
Yeah, me neither. I'm not even close to sure if I'm being right.
But what about the rest? What about the White Queen? What about Forge? Any thoughts on those things?
Oh, well, let's see, no, because it kind of spoils it for me because I already know what's going on there. So
gotcha.
I have nothing to add there, but spoilers, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's only one more issue of each, and then I imagine some of the stuff still plays out in, you know, in X-Men and the other particular titles. So I guess the last thing we'll mention is R.B. Silva on the art. I feel like, for me, this is the best. I think R.B. Silva's art looks great. It looks fantastic, especially the scenes with Forge, because they're meeting. I didn't mention this when I talked before. They're meeting in someplace underwater. Where you can see in the background all these different sea animals swimming around. So I think the art is as good as it has been throughout. It's very, R.B. Silva has been very consistent, especially the facial expressions and the body language, because they're dealing with a lot of politics here, and it's a lot of sort of quote unquote talking head scenes, and you can get real bored looking at those. But he does a great job of changing around the poses of characters and showing a lot of emotion in the faces. But for me, where the art shines in this issue is the color work from Marte Garcia, especially in the scenes that are underwater. They're just cool to look at. I found myself staring at the backgrounds going, oh, look, there's a turtle, or there's a shark, or there's a whatnot. Like, it's a super interesting way to keep us engaged when really there's no action in this issue. This is all just talking heads. You know, it's all characters and political stuff. With maybe the exception of the panel where the Phalanx eats the elder. It's about the only action in the whole issue. But I didn't know it. You're not aware of it because it's done so well and it's paced so well. So I thought the color work, especially, like I said, was done really, really well. So anything else to add, Jean-Paul?
I was just looking at it. I don't know if this was just me, but I got a Lex Luthor vibe from Professor X in this conversation with him and Forge. Did you get that? Like, just his expressions? And...
Yeah, the one particular panel, I definitely got a, well, that's a little malevolent look, where he says, the only question is, are you or are you not going to build it for me?
Right.
The panel right before that. Yeah, it's a little mustache twirling moment from Professor X. And yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. And I mean, and again, throughout this whole two series, you know, I'm not 100% in with Professor X and thinking everything is on the up and up with him. I feel like there's things that he's keeping to himself that maybe, I mean, we're already talking about some of the things that they're doing are ethically questionable. And I think there are things that we don't even know yet that could go beyond that. Cause here's the thing, like, we're seeing Professor X without the big fishbowl helmet on, and we're already seeing where, ooh, maybe he's stepping over the line or he's in a gray area. You put the helmet on him where you can't even see his facial expressions, and you really start to wonder, is he going too far, and what does he know, and what is he keeping a secret? But yeah, I agree with you. Definitely get a little bit of a Luther vibe, or at least a supervillain vibe from Professor X in that scene for sure.
But other than that, I dig the artwork too. This very well could have been a boring issue if the artwork wasn't as good as it was.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. So,
right. Not to say that the dialogue was boring, though.
No.
But I'm just saying, like,
yeah, it's all really well paced. But again, like I said, there's not any action. It's all dialogue and characters talking. But it's interesting. I mean, the whole interaction with Magneto and Professor X and White Queen was done really, really well. So. So hats off to the entire creative team. And that leaves us with only two issues to go, one more for House of X and one more for Powers of 10. And then we'll start diving into the Dawn of X books as the new series started. So anything else to add, John Paul?
That's it.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. As always, really appreciate your support. Numbers, downloads, and whatnot continue to grow over here. So we really appreciate everybody. You know, tuning in and you know, rating us on iTunes and all those crazy podcast platforms that are out there these days. And, you know, we encourage you all to engage with us on social media, engage with other comic fans, and, you know, tell them to listen. And we want to hear everybody's thoughts and everybody's opinions, because we do this because we love comics and we want to share our love of comics for you. So, yeah, we really appreciate the support as always. So that's going to do it for this episode, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.